I would think it would center rather on Hegel. You've already had some discussions in sections, but you may have some additional questions you would like to ask me. This is your chance. Yes.
But is Hegel saying that the individual only realizes his true value by living in an organized state?
Yes. Yes. Hegel, yes. It depends when. You mustn't forget, there is the young Hegel in his enthusiasm for the French Revolution, with whom the state was of relatively minor importance. And you only realize your full value as your self-consciousness grows and mediates between your own individuality and history. But in the end, certainly, you only realize your full value in the state, because he thought then that the state was the framework within which a harmony might be possible between your own self-consciousness taking back the things that are yours, you see, and understanding the totality of history. You see what I mean?
The state is different from our present conception of the state. When I think of the state, I think of government and bureaucracy and those things.
Ah, government and bureaucracy and those things. Well, all right, no. The state for him, it's a good question. The state for him, as for all of these people we are going to deal with, is of course the state at an earlier stage. That is to say, the state in Central Europe as a cultural phenomenon. This would be true in Italy too. And the stress on culture, on a shared past, shared symbols, shared myths. Because remember, these were not United States, yes? But inasmuch as Hegel was really more a Prussian patriot than a German patriot, certainly the state also had a bureaucracy from the 18th century, one that was trying to be more efficient, yes? But nobody looked at the state as being symbolized by its bureaucracy, because for Hegel, of course, it was a monarchy. So the state was symbolized by the king. Yes? And in France, where there was no longer a king, it was symbolized by Marianne, by myths and symbols, but not by bureaucracy, as your question is. No. No. To a certain extent in Prussia, the state was symbolized by universal military service. This comes, remember, from Prussia's indefensible borders. From Prussia was a new nation, relatively, a nation without any natural borders, yes? Therefore, as somebody said, it was not a state with an army, but an army with a state. And that was, to a certain extent, true, yes? If you say liberal state, conservative state, or so on, this has to do now with the power of the monarch. That is, in a liberal state, the monarch becomes not a constitutional monarch in our sense as yet. That is, a monarch who rules but does not reign. That English model of constitutional monarchy was, of course, not a model for the continent of Europe as yet, but a monarch whose power was limited by laws. You'll see a little more of that when we talk about liberalism. By laws which guaranteed people's rights. Eventually there'll be agitation for constitutions which guarantee people's rights over against the monarch. But the problem here of a liberal state is the problem of a constitutional monarchy apart from France. You see, you must look at it that way. You see, the monarch's power circumscribed by laws or by a constitution. Yes, please.
What is the relationship then between, well, if there is any, between Rousseau's state and community of affinity and what Hegel is talking about?
But Hegel's state is Rousseau's state, the community of affinity, is what I would call, what you would call a town meeting. It is a state where consensus reigns. As everybody is good, everybody meets together, there's bound to be a consensus once the distorting and oppressive and corrupting authority is removed. And to get a new kind of state, a community of affinity, Rousseau assumed a consensus, but he also, of course, was a little more practical, inasmuch as in the social contract he had this legislature who prepared legislation. But that legislation would be in concert with reason. It would be rational legislation, yes? But Hegel's state is a quite different state. It is what we call in Germany an Obrigkeit state, a state of authority, a state which consists of a hierarchy of authorities. There is no contradiction between a hierarchy of authorities and the rule of law. Law itself is an authority. Law has nothing to do with consensus. Laws are made and laws are obeyed. And there is a king, and there is a diet, or there isn't a diet, it doesn't matter much. There is executive power. So that, on the whole, it's a quite different kind of state. It is what we call in Germany a state of authority, where the citizen is part of a network of authorities. It's the difference, let us say, today of a neighborhood center. Oh, I don't really know what a neighborhood center is. I just read about it in the newspapers. You know, you all meet together and you decide by consensus, something or other, whatever. And a state, yes? So Rousseau's state is a utopia. Rousseau was thinking of Geneva. Geneva had about 15,000 inhabitants. You can't even do that with 15,000 inhabitants, what Rousseau said, probably. But Hegel's was the Prussian state. That was something quite different. You see what I mean? I'm not saying that Rousseau's state as utopia won't persist. It will persist as a utopia of consensus. But it depends also, remember, Rousseau's state on an economic equality. That is to say, he didn't think that in this community of affinity there would be rich and there would be poor. You may not remember that, but when you read Emile, there was quite a lot in it about equaling out wealth. It depends on this idea of a yeoman society, the free man on his free acres, everybody having a little property and nobody having too much property. It's the old, what I would call Lockean or Jacobin ideal. You see what I mean?
So what role did equality play in Hegel's state?
The equality in Hegel's state is only there inasmuch as he wants an abolition of the division of labor. The division of labor has to be abolished, but Hegel never talks about abolishing a hierarchy of authority or doing away with labor. Hegel wants to transform labor into more humanized labor. Perhaps he was even thinking of landed labor, as they all were, labor on the land. But there's nothing else about equality in Hegel. Nothing at all. Nothing at all. There were workers and there were proprietors. Yes? In other words, Hegel was in no sense whatsoever, a precursor of socialism, except in his opposition to the division of labor, which doesn't necessarily mean equality. It just means perhaps a more meaningful labor. And Hegel had that same idea that Nietzsche will have later, that you solve the working classes through having the industrial workers emigrate to the colonies. And there they can be a peasant on his own acres. That was later on Nietzsche's solution to the social question. Get rid of the proletariat, send it to the colonies, There they can have their acres, and they can be a free man on a free acre. It was a very seducive idea, because there was, of course, enough land there. It was partly true, of course. So Hegel had that. Yes, please.
There was economic equality, but not political equality?
No, for Hegel, there was no economic equality at all. There was no equality for Hegel. None. Abolition, the division of labor, you always think of it immediately in Marxist terms, but you mustn't think of it in Marxist terms. For Marx, the abolition of labor meant equality, the abolition of the capitalist system. But not for Hegel. He didn't think of this at all. Socialism in Hegel's lifetime was at best a French phenomena, but was certainly quite unknown in Germany of the 1830s. When Marx wanted to learn about socialism, he had to go to Paris. He couldn't learn about it in Germany at all. So he simply meant by abolition of labor, if you like, to reappropriate the things that are his. He meant an independent peasantry, that's all. Independent freeholder, yes? And that's very traditional. You get that from the levelers in the English Revolution, through the Jacobins, through the founding of America. He was in that, through Locke, he was in that tradition to solve the social question by a nation of independent peasants. You see what I mean? It's a pre-industrial version. It comes to you from underdeveloped Germany. It doesn't come to you from France. It doesn't come to you from England. Yes? So that's what's important. Yes, please.
I understand your lecture says that the dialectic process is always a process of unbecoming. There's no ultimate end. But in the book, I think Hegel points out that the absolute freedom is a kind of final end to be realized. So if there's no ultimate end in the dialectic process, does that imply that it is beyond human capacity to reach the final freedom?
I understand what you're saying. I would say that has to be answered in two ways. It first of all has to be answered through the thing that, of course, not within yourself, but within history, there is an absolute freedom which always wants out. That in history is a development towards an absolute freedom. Now, your second question, where is this absolute freedom to be found? What is it? Is it ever a possibility? That goes to the problem which I haven't really addressed at all. The problem of Hegel and religion. And what one must say there is, this is quite a disputed business, what one must say there is that in this part of Hegel, whether absolute freedom is realizable, even in the Prussian state, whether it is realizable at all, which is, after all, your question, right? I think Hegel's Lutheranism comes in, yes? I've got to put it this way, I think, that for Hegel, no doubt, who was a Lutheran theologian, Christianity was the perfect religion. There is no doubt it has to be, because it supersedes Judaism. It's higher than Judaism on the dialectical ladder, yes, Christianity, yes? But on the other hand, philosophy and religion are for him largely the same, yes? Now, what he therefore took from Lutheranism and what you can take from Lutheranism are two things. First of all, not to be too theological, what distinguished Luther from Calvin and Catholicism is that for Luther, heaven was not a fixed place. Heaven was in a way relativized for Martin Luther. And that therefore you could stress in Luther the growth of the spirit rather than having some concrete idea of what heaven is, yes? Rather than have some concrete idea of the nature of heaven, which some can derive from the Bible, angels, and all of that, he relativized it. So that the spirit can be stressed. Therefore, in every moral act of man, the spirit, you can call it if you like, the spirit of Christianity, penetrates into history, penetrates into history. And the freedom becomes a totality. Now, here there is another analogy with which I really hate to bother you, but it's quite strong in Hegel, and which has to do with the Trinity, Father God and Holy Spirit. What Hegel says that the Trinity is symbolic because Christ is both man and God. Yes? And then there's the Holy Spirit, which can be in men. So that, in a sense, Christianity foreshadows a totality of things. Man and God and man and the Holy Spirit means that there is a totality which is partly outside and partly inside history, which is partly in your own self-consciousness and the growth of your own self-consciousness, and part in history. Yes? So that what you have here really is, first of all, I would say, Christianity as symbolic, potentially and latently symbolic, of the highest kind of freedom, through its symbol, really, first of the spirit, the idea in history, and secondly, of the Trinity. That is to say, the Trinity, which is the paradigm, if you like, of an idea of totality, Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And it is a paradigm of totality because it combines the present and the future and your own self-consciousness. The Holy Spirit is always driving your own self-consciousness to the greater totality, as it were. And, of course, if you like, Christ as man is history, and Christ as God is the unrealized history, the history that must yet be realized. So I would say that this matter of absolute freedom is imminent in Hegel, within his view, his peculiar view of Lutheranism and Lutheran Christianity, which is possible because of Lutheran Christianity's stress, really, on the spirit as over against, most other things, yes? And the relativizing. Don't forget one thing which is relevant here. All the great scientific discoveries were made at Lutheran universities, not at Calvinist universities, not at Catholic universities. From Copernicus on in the 16th century, they were all made at Lutheran universities because Lutheranism was especially hospitable to the new sciences because of the relativizing element, if I can put it that way, in Lutheranism, that heaven is no longer a fixed place, that there is therefore a great room for men to penetrate into the universe, which you don't have in Calvinism, and you certainly don't have in Catholicism in this sense. So you'll find that the great modern scientific discoveries at universities were made at Lutheran universities, Lutheran foundations. And Hegel continues that particular Lutheran tradition. I might say that that tradition was further underlined by Pietism. After all, Pietism had spiritualized Lutheranism still more, had still more made it a thing of the spirit, yes? You see, I have to answer you in this way, yeah? You understand what I mean. And it has to do with this very vexed matter of the Trinity, and the Trinity taken here as a paradigm, yes? In which Hegel believed. Hegel was a Lutheran minister. Yes?
Yeah, I'm actually used the concept of paradox.
Yeah, yes.
I just wonder if you could, that was unclear with me, I just wonder if you could elaborate on that.
I used the concept of paradox in the lecture by saying, I think, and I'm quite sure, that in the end, Hegel is a kind of paradox. On the one hand, there is freedom, but the struggle for freedom can only be brought about through unfreedom. That is to say, as every historical event fulfills a purpose, and the purpose of that historical event is to advance both your self-consciousness and history, yes? Therefore, Hegel said, for example, himself, the Greek despotism was justified, because Greek despotism destroyed what is and advanced the new. So Napoleon occupation, if you like, is justified, because it produced, if you like, the new, the struggles for national unification. Hegel would say the new Prussia, the new reform Prussia with its laws, and so on. That's what I meant by paradox, that the struggle for freedom, the dialectic, is always, in a way, the destruction is always a part of it. Now, obviously, the paradox is greater in the young Hegelian and Marx than in Hegel. There, this process of destruction becomes a process of revolution. There, the old order must be forcibly destroyed before the new one comes up. And that fastens on to Caesar and Napoleon and Greek despotism. But for Hegel, that was not the case, because Hegel believed there could be a more gentle evolution. That is, you didn't really need Caesars or Napoleons or destruction. You could have a more gentle evolution because in that dialectic, there could be a compromise. In other words, for these young people, no compromise was possible. The young Hegelians didn't believe in compromise. Therefore, there had to be a struggle. But for Hegel, compromise was very possible. And so the old order and the new first compromise before the victim of the new, yes? As I told you in a kind of picture way, that the baby is delivered normally in Hegel and through a Caesarean in Marx. In Marx, it is a struggle. I mean, not only in Marx, in the young Hegelians, yes? And these are the kind of paradoxes. But you must be aware of something else in paradox, which you're probably already aware of, that the metaphor of paradox is one thing, is one way with dealing with, if you like, to put it in a grandiose way, the contradictions of life. And that is why every great religious prophet always speaks in paradoxes. Christ spoke in paradoxes. Moses spoke in paradoxes. They always speak in paradoxes. And as Goethe put it in the end himself, that out of darkness shall come light. That's a paradox, yes? So there are always paradoxes, because that is one way to cope with the existential situation. And in the end, paradoxes become the whole philosophy of existentialism in modern times. Is based on paradoxes. Therefore, you should not be surprised to have Hegel speak in paradoxes as well. Now, of course, there were others. Nietzsche also, to a certain degree, speaks in paradoxes, yes? But that's deep in our civilization, because if you think the deepest trend in our civilization is, of course, the Christian trend of death and salvation, that is a paradox. That salvation can only come out of death, that you don't find in other cultures. You don't find in China or in Buddhist culture or anywhere. That's a particular masochism of Christian culture, of course, that salvation can only come out of death.
Yes.
So you begin really with a paradox here, yes, which of course integrates something unacceptable and gives you hope, a death, yes? It's a way of coping with death, something very elementary. Some way of coping with death, of course. And in our sense, it becomes very important as a justification of nationalism later. Transposing, as I said to you, this kind of rhythm, Christian rhythm of death and salvation, to death for the fatherland. It's the same kind of rhythm. It's the same kind of idea. Except that everybody can be Christ that way. And that was quite openly said in the First World War, and even in the Wars of Liberation, that every soldier now can be Christ. Every soldier imitates Christ by dying for the fatherland. So that the basic paradox here is a way of coping with death, explaining away death, which is, after all, basic. So again, it may make it easier for you to understand to say that paradoxes are essential to the whole Christian civilization of which we are all a part, which is our civilization. In that civilization, this is, I think, absolutely the essential rhythm. And it is so essential, just one final word, that in every crisis, it comes up again. In every crisis and bewilderment, you get it up again, namely the basic Christian rhythm of death and salvation. In war, in the facing of mass death, in the facing, if you like, of any kind of catastrophe, yes? Because it has to do with sacrifice and martyrdom, and in a way, with coming to life, to terms with life, in making life not all that important. And today we know it by your bumper stickers, rather dead than red. It's the same sort of thing, you know? Because if you die against a communist, you're bound to come to heaven. It's bound to imitate Christ, yes? So, but not against a communist. You can do it against a Frenchman, against whatever you like. I mean, it depends where you are. Doesn't make any difference. The rhythm is always the same, yes? It's the enemy of your nation, real or imagined, mostly, of course, imagined. The enemy of your nation, real and imagined. And I'm not saying that this is only a bad thing of nationalism. It probably fulfills a deep human need, the need for a meaningful life, because your life perfectly dreary as I look at you. And it could be possibly made more meaningful if you put on the uniform and died for your country or died for a harder cause. It is again, you see, it's difficult to explain to you perhaps, a means of integration, of pulling down a piece of eternity into your life. Your life becomes meaningful. And don't forget that soldiers were blessed in church before they went off to battle in the wars of liberation now. It's your life is more meaningful. Your life becomes meaningful. You integrate yourself with the camaraderie, with the camaraderie. You do this now in rock and roll to a certain extent in these rhythms, yes? It's much the same way in these rhythms, yes? But before you had jazz, before you had these rhythms, you had folk dances and so on, to be sure. But the real end integration was, in a sense, a national integration. You do it in football games, of course. In all these things, you're reaching out to integrate yourself with a higher kind of unity. You see, that goes back to the question you asked about Rousseau's community of affinity. And the only way you're trying to participate, and in mass society, the only way of participating is to yell in unison with others, if you want to put it at its bottom line. Yeah. Yeah. But it gives you a feeling of participation. It's like sing a hymn. These are all Christian rhythms that you do when you watch these football games. It's a mixture between Roman gladiators and Christian rhythms, I suppose. Yeah? Except you're not feeding Christians to the lion, but you're seeing other people maul themselves. So you have all the same sort of things, I think. Yeah, please.
I have a question about the role of religious authority in all of
this. Yes, please.
And what was happening to Pietism after especially after you had mentioned this, you know, growing importance of medical and legal authority in deciding what was right and wrong and normal.
You must distinguish here between Catholicism and Protestantism. Catholicism had what so many call a misfortune, a great misfortune, at the beginning of the 19th century, namely that the papacy was in the custodian of the most backward part of Catholic Europe, Italy. And I mean this quite seriously. The papacy was in the hands of the most underdeveloped part of Europe, Italy. So that the papacy became a reactionary force throughout the 19th and much of the 20th century. And because it did that, in a sense did something very good in a way. It kept itself as an institution separate from modernity to a certain extent, yes, and put forward an image which was medieval, romantic, yes, yeah, ever more obsessed with the authority of the Pope as over the authority of the state. And of course that was bound to non-success in the end. But the question that you're really asking is not about Catholicism, because the Catholic regions of Europe remained traditional, very traditional rural regions, by the way. If they were urban regions until the mid-century, when it begins to change fairly rapidly, fairly traditional. And we don't have time to deal here, eventually with the rise of social Catholicism. So then I would say, if you deal with the Catholic Church, you are dealing with a conservative force which tries to modernize itself at mid-century, very much against the papacy. Most of these people were excommunicated eventually, but which remained a separate force, really much untouched, if you like, by the forces of industrialism and modernity until, I would say, the second half of the 19th century, the end of the 19th century, this began to cause a great deal of trouble. But your question is really directed at Protestantism, because it is Protestantism we've been dealing with. These great systems of thoughts are Protestant thought. Now, there is a reason for that, and that is Protestantism, in a sense, lost its theology. Now, it's very, very devastating if a religion loses its theology, for a reason that if a religion loses its theology, anything else can move in to take its part. I mean, eventually you have German Christians, you have everything, yes? Eventually you sit on a baseball court, eventually you have a Christianity that preaches be good to your neighbor and nothing more. Now, the Catholic Church was successful in the 19th century, of keeping its theology intact. And that, I think, is very important, through its conservatism, and thereby keeping its followers, or if whatever you want to call it, keeping its congregation, its flock, intact. Protestantism was not. Protestantism became, in effect, a state church. And Protestant ministers praised nationalism, praised the state. I'm going to come back to that in another thing, like Schleiermacher in Germany. It was first in Protestant liturgy that you introduced, for example, the hour in memory of those who died for the fatherland. The Catholics were very much against that at first, because what did dead dying with the fatherland for Prussia have to do with Catholicism? But Protestantism immediately introduced that famous prayer for the fallen and the dead. So that Protestantism becomes a state church and becomes bound up with a state church. Now, apart from Catholicism, which managed it with some difficulty, not always, because there's a modernist movement, these people were excommunicated. Official Catholicism, which froze its theology, and by that, at least for a time, kept it intact. I think Protestantism went quite a different way, and so did the Jews, by the way. Other things came to take its place. Now, The Jews lost their theology in Central and Western Europe, and what came to take its place there are middle-class morals. In other words, the Jews have to behave right, and they have to dress right, and they have to adjust. That's what the rabbis preached, probably Reform rabbis from then to today, I don't know. A middle-class morality, yes, as a part of the process of assimilation. For Protestantism, what went into it was middle-class morality, but also nationalism. Well, for the Jews as well, of course. I should say for Judaism and Protestantism in Central and Western Europe, for Protestantism almost everywhere, what went to take the place of theology through Pietism. Pietism had diluted theology. Was nationalism and middle-class morality. We should come to it. It was one of the great institutionalizers of middle-class morality. Now, I said, quite rightly, the doctors came to control sex, but certainly the ministers assisted the doctors, but the ministers are apt to use medical vocabulary. They are, because it broadens up. After all, the ministers now are concerned not just with procreation, as it is in the Bible, but they are concerned with all your sexual behavior, with what you would call dating and mating and whatever, and dressing and everything, yes? So they now use the vocabulary of sickness and health, just as they use the national vocabulary, yes? Of the nation and its enemy. Because remember one thing, Lutheran, the highest Lutheran authority in Prussia is the king. These are state churches, you forget that. Lutheranism is a state church. Lutheran bishops are appointed by the ruler. Yes? Don't forget that, yes? With Calvinism, it was a little different. They weren't appointed by the ruler. But the end effect was not much different. The Prussian state was a mixture between Lutheranism and Calvinism. It's called the Church of the Prussian Union. It was much earlier a mixture, but I can't be concerned with this. So these are state churches. Religious authority in Protestantism comes from the ruler down. Don't forget that. Yeah?
Vocabulary of the physicians.
Yeah.
The physicians, in turn, though, would make their judgments about what they were studying, what was right, what was wrong, and moral, on the basis of their religious.
Not so much, because they extended it much beyond any religion. As I've told you before the 18th century, religion was in sexual matters, religion and the father confessors in Catholicism, but also Protestantism, before the evangelical revival. Only asked you one question. Did you use sex for procreation? That's all. And they were not greatly interested if, let us say, in the foreplay, if I can use that. You know what that is. If you don't, I'm not going to explain it. The foreplay, the afterplay, or whatever. The petting, or whatever, yes? Homosexual or lesbian petting or foreplay or afterplay. Doesn't interest them. The only thing is the sin of Sodom. Did you spill your seed on the ground? If you spilled your seed on the ground, then you had committed an evil. But as long as you did anything else and didn't spill your seed on the ground or didn't spill your seed at all, then it was not anything. And masturbation anyway was excluded. That is for some reason excluded. They didn't ask you about that in any case. So in other words, there was a tightening of sexual and a broadening and tightening of sexual prohibitions, which came from the medical profession, much more from religion, though the pietists worked hand in hand with it. The pietists, of course, worked hand in hand with it, the sins of the flesh against the spirit. That's obvious, yes? The pietists were hand in hand with it. But I would give certainly the priority now to the medical profession. In two ways you can see that. First of all, these sermons of the Protestant ministers, they are concerned with all of this, especially in England, we shall see, in a medical vocabulary. But certainly from mid-century on, if parents wanted to, clarify or tell their children about how babies were born, that it was no longer the stork, they were not likely to send them to the minister, they were likely to send them to a family doctor. And that has remained, more or less, I think, constant. So that I'm not saying the minister played no role, but I think after the second half of the 19th century, that's pretty much proven, he played a subservient role to the doctor. Now, you must exempt Catholic regions. Catholic regions were the most tolerant regions about sexuality. For example, Bavaria, which has a bad name for intolerance, if you don't know it, never had a law prohibiting homosexuality. Never at all. Never at all. Because that was really not the concern of Catholic father confessors. And when the German Empire was established in 1870, the Empire adopted strict laws against homosexuality, famous paragraph 175, which had to be imposed on Bavaria. The Empire had two choices, the Bavarian model or the Protestant model, because it's a Protestant empire very largely. It went with the Protestant, and if you like, the repressive model. Where Bavaria, like all Catholic region on sexual matters, were in fact the non-repressive model. That's often forgotten these days. So what you have there is a different kind of thing. So I'm not saying religion isn't important. It's very important. But the medical profession becomes really more important after the second in defining what people mean by health and sickness. Because there's one other thing I want to say. The last thing, once it's no longer a sin, once it's health and sickness, and it is connected with the idea of decadence, you're locked in. There are outward signs now of inward grace. You're locked in. And in Christianity, you can never be locked in. There's always room for conversion. That goes with it. But in medicine, there is no room of conversion. Especially the doctors in mid-century who began to elaborate the idea of decadence, the idea that you can read this by your outward appearance. You're locked in. So that's a very important thing. And eventually, the way people will regard good behavior and middle-class morality is by being locked in. The possibility of conversion becomes less. Don't you see that that goes outside the Christian realm? The possibility of conversion is always there. Even when you have a purity crusade, especially, let's take the English purity crusade of mid-century. You weren't locked in if a prostitute, a homosexual, converted, and took up what they called a decent profession, usually became a servant, the prostitute became a household servant or something. That was fine. Even got a grant, as we would say, to help her along, yes? She was not locked in. There was no such thing in these Christian purity crusades as locking the prostitute in, you see? But once you operate with the term degeneration, you lock them in. It's a very important thing, yeah? Am I making myself clear?
You see?
Yeah. You're not locked in. But eventually you do become locked in. So I would finally say is that the triumph of medicine, which you mentioned, has a lot to do with the greater and greater fears of bourgeois society. The more fears bourgeois society has of its enemies from below and from above, and from its own youth, above all from its own youth. It's a myth that the middle class feared the working class at the end of the century. That's nonsense. It feared its own children, which were rebelling against it. And the more they feared their own children, there's nothing worse, I suppose, not being able to control your own children. Thank God I never made the experiment. But if you do, it's probably doomed to disaster. So you can't control your own children. They became fearful, and medicine catered to that fear, yes? So the fear of the middle class from its own offspring is, I think, vital for the triumph of medicine. You see what I mean? Yeah? They didn't go to religion. Also, one other thing, by that time, religion had lost a lot of its force. It had lost a lot of its force, except in Catholic regions, and you wouldn't do it. It wasn't very forceful. You see what I mean? Yes? In a secular age, in case you hadn't realized that yet, the doctor is the new priest. Hadn't you realized that? No? That's why so many of you who in old societies would have been priests, now stream to medical school. It's not just you want to cure, you want to have authority. You also want to make money. Well, that's it, too liberally. We'll have sections this week.